It's Leap Day, 2012, February 29th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 38, Intelligent Life in the Universe. The theme of this part of class is looking for life on other worlds. We've talked a lot about the lifetimes of stars and how that determines where the habitable zones are, what types of stars are likely hospitable to life. We especially spent the last couple of days talking about the searches for other planets and what it is we're going to go looking for. The real goal of a lot of the science that's going on now, and we're not there yet, but we're getting really close, is to find an Earth-like planet in the habitable zone of its parent star. Once we find one of those, we talked a lot yesterday about how we would want to look at various spectroscopic biomarkers, that even though we can't go there yet, because it's technologically very infeasible to travel the great distances between the stars, using spectroscopy and the way in which light and matter imprint the passes of each other on that light signal, we can learn a great deal about that planet. We can learn, in fact, whether it's got life, whether it's got things that look like what life was like on the Earth. Today I want to talk about a topic that really gets down to the heart of what it is, why we're all interested in whether there's life on other worlds, and that is, of course, the question of intelligent life in the universe. And today we want to say a little bit about what is it, how do we define intelligent life? Again, like we were trying to do before, we want to look for life, we've got to have a definition of life. If I now want to add that adjective, intelligent life, I need a definition of intelligence. What am I looking for? So this is the real goal of things. Finding life would be interesting. Finding intelligent life would be even more interesting. Just saying, oh, that planet's covered with plants. That's cool. That would be an actually very exciting, even perhaps even transformative thing. But if we actually met an intelligent species on another star, that would be revolutionary in many ways to the way which we view ourselves in the universe. But in order to start that search, we have to have some idea of what it is we're looking for. So we need a working definition of intelligence. And we're going to develop a definition which is going to be very simplified, and I'll admit it's very simplified, which includes things like self-awareness, the use of tools, and the use of languages. And we'll see some example of how that works. We're going to look at ways in which we can approximately quantify what constitutes intelligence, something called the encephalization quotient, which appears to correlate pretty well with intelligence and may in fact be a mildly heritable trait. And we'll look at some of the evidence for that studying intelligent species here on the Earth. And you'll notice I use the plural, not the singular. On Earth, however, there's also a fairly sobering aspect to this lesson. Human intelligence, what we really are using as our template definition of intelligence, took 4 billion years to develop on this planet. That's going to set some interesting limits on what it is we're going to go looking for. Because remember, when we're looking at a planet, we find another planet around another star out there. There's no guarantee it's as old as our Earth. It could be a brand new planet, or it could be much older. And so the time it takes intelligence to arise is one of the factors that comes into play when we're trying to assess whether intelligent life exists elsewhere. Finally, if intelligent beings do in fact emerge on other worlds, and they develop what we call advanced technology, and we'll define what we mean by advanced technology, then one of the things that enables them to do is to make their existence known to the universe. So this isn't just simply a statistical exercise, it's also setting up what the criteria would be for how we would recognize an intelligent species through the use of advanced technology. And I need to define what I mean by advanced technology because it informs some of the rest of what we're going to be exploring as we go out and look at what are the prospects for life and especially intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. Well, this is sort of a nice encapsulation of what we talked about yesterday. We find an Earth in the habitable zone of its parent star. There are spectroscopic biomarkers that we can use to see the presence of biological activity as we understand it here on the Earth. Those have to do with the presence of things like oxygen and ozone that we know within an oxidizing atmosphere require the presence of photosynthetic life. We can use the reflectance spectrum and look for the red edge. We might actually see photosynthetic life that had a similar molecular approach to photosynthesis as chlorophyll-based photosynthesis on the Earth. And all of those things would be very interesting. Let's say we would find methane. Maybe we wouldn't find oxygen. We'd find methane, which is a biomarker of early forms of life. If you were to look at the Earth from far away, when the Earth was only about 2 billion years old, there wasn't much oxygen in the atmosphere, but there was a lot of methane in the atmosphere because we had an anaerobic forms of life, were the dominant forms of life on the Earth then. And we could detect that presence as well. A strong CO2 atmosphere is an oxidizing atmosphere, but the presence of methane gets there through anaerobic biological processes. So all of these things could point to the presence of life generically. That would be fascinating. In fact, it would probably be in many ways a real changing experience for humanity. But finding intelligent extraterrestrial life would be even more interesting. In fact, I would go so far as to say it would be evolutionary. It would be one of the few real game changers to come along in human history, because it would once and for all tell us that we weren't alone. It would cast our own existence and history into very sharp relief if we knew there was somebody else out there. The desire to communicate with them, to go visit them, would be absolutely overwhelming, and it really would change the course of human history by doing that. One hopes it does so in a good way. Often encounters with intelligence and advanced civilizations didn't work out so well in the history of the Earth, and so it's something we've got to always take a little deep breath in considering. And we'll talk a little bit about that later when we talk about the whole question of contact and other things with intelligent life in the universe. Now, historically, really, this is getting down really to the heart of this course. The reason why I'm sure that many of you signed up for this course is because it fit into your schedule and met your requirements. But there's another reason why this course probably appealed to you, is this idea of intelligent life and the interest in intelligent life on other worlds is deeply embedded in our culture. We've seen this, we've mentioned this throughout the course. But really, when you look at things from War of the Worlds, E.T., now a 30-year-old movie, and, of course, The Simpsons, as you know, multiple points of reference within our culture, there's a fascination with the idea that life is intelligent somewhere. Not only do we see this in various pieces of literature, but really, if you wanted to pick up one gauge of how much intelligent life, the idea of intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, captures our imagination, consider the top 7 highest-grossing domestic films of all time. Right? They are Avatar, Titanic, The Dark Knight, Star Wars, the original, Shrek 2, E.T., and Star Wars 1. That was, that guy. If you look at the top 7 most-grossing films of all time in the United States, 4 of those 7 deal with intelligent beings that are not human. So we really, really do care about this. We want to meet intelligent species. We are fascinated by the thought of meeting someone else, of finding out that we're not alone, not just in terms of just life processes, but actually intelligent life. The problem is, in order to understand that, we have to have a reasonable definition of what do I mean by intelligent? Well, here's a cartoon here. It's the classic, not terribly enlightening way of expressing evolution, which shows, you know, the lower forms of life eat, survive, reproduce. And finally, the human there, standing there, saying, what is it all about? That, in many ways, is a somewhat of a comic encapsulation of one of the aspects of intelligence that we have. We are capable of asking the question, what is intelligence? We become aware of ourselves and aware of what intelligence means. So we really would like to come up with a definition of intelligence. The problem is, we struggled with this early in the course. We wanted to define what it meant for life and how you define the line between living and non-living. We found that we could come up with a reasonable set of criteria, but there were exceptions, and it was difficult, and in fact quite contentious. Well, if you think defining life is difficult and contentious, try defining intelligence, or perhaps consciousness. I've spent a lot of my adult life, you know, reading various books, both of the popular level books and somewhat more advanced books, bearing on the question of things like consciousness and intelligence, because it's something that's always interested me. How do we define this amazing capability we human beings have of viewing the world, of thinking ahead of things, of how are we even conscious? And I realize that after years of study, I really don't understand intelligence. And as near as I can tell from the books I've read, neither does anyone else. And I've sat a few times on a few philosophy PhD dissertations as the outside committing member, and they don't get it either. It's a really hard problem, and part of it is because it's kind of turning back on ourselves. You know, the sort of the old Descartes idea of I think, therefore I am. If I'm thinking about myself, is that thinking? You know, you can get into trouble with that. You need a couple beers to really get through that, you know, and actually sort of make sense of it. And I have a feeling that philosophers, I think, spend a lot of time drinking beer. But here's my crack at it. And this is pretty consistent with the way I think the basics of intelligence. Now, is it a complete definition of intelligence? No, but it's a reasonable starting point. I think my philosophy colleagues would consider this a hopelessly utilitarian way of looking at it. I don't really want a global definition of intelligence that's right for all times and all possibilities. I want a practical definition of intelligence that's going to be useful to me if I'm going to be going out and looking for other intelligent civilizations elsewhere in the universe. So yes, I'm going to come up with a fairly constricted, limited definition of intelligence, and that's just too damn bad. So, first and foremost, let's go back to the question raised by that cartoon. Self-awareness, we think, is probably part of what we consider by intelligence. We can ask the question, what is it all about? We get beyond the basic biological directives of eat, survive, reproduce. And we start asking, what's the purpose of that? What's the meaning of that? Why do we do that? We ask the question why, not just what's for dinner and am I going to be able to mate before something eats me. The second piece of intelligence that's useful is we notice that intelligent species that we recognize or intelligent behaviors include the use of tools to manipulate our environment. We aren't simply limited to our hands, but we actually build mechanical things to extend our senses, extend our ability. We build optics to look further. We build systems that allow us to enhance our vision. We build lever arms and grabbers, which basically are extensions of the human body in order to magnify our ability to enhance our surroundings. We can do things and manipulate our environment, sometimes for good, sometimes not so much, but we still have the ability to go beyond simply our inborn abilities to manipulate the environment. Finally, and I think this is something that everyone would agree is a hallmark of intelligence, is the use of language to communicate with other intelligent beings. Call it abstract reasoning, call it consciousness, call it symbolic logic, whatever you want. After all, I'm communicating with you not only by making noises with a couple of funny folds of skin in my throat, tickling little folds of skin and bones in your ear, but we are communicating even if I just shut up for a second. You'd be able to get the basic gist of what I'm talking about because you know how to string together these 26 symbols plus another 10 other symbols representing numeration, and you can gain meaning from that. I am communicating with you. The point of language is communication. It has no other purpose that anyone can possibly discern, except maybe people like to hear the sound of themselves making noise. But beyond that, if it actually has a usefulness, there it is. A cat meows at me, it's a vocalization. It could mean anything from I love you to feed me, damn it. But a human being can make that far more clear through the use of language. And we don't have to be language necessarily meaning speech. There are other ways to make noise and communicate through patternings of sounds. That's what speech is. It's just a pattern of sounds you recognize. Symbols in sound rather than symbols in sight. Okay, that's getting a little heavy. Let's move on and try to get some examples. Human intelligence is obvious. Look around you. But on Earth, there are other species, there are other elements that appear to be intelligent by these criteria to different extents and in different ways. Let's take, for example, use of language. Dolphins have a very, very sophisticated systems of vocalization. They can make noises, ticks, and pops, which are beautifully adapted to transmission of sound waves in water. They can also transmit them in air, the chattering and giggling that you hear from dolphins. But in fact, people who study dolphins extensively find that dolphins communicate within groups using so-called contact calls. And furthermore, it's been noticed that every dolphin creates its own signature whistle that it can preface or end a series of chatters, chirps, and buzzes with that is its own and it's unique. It is essentially the dolphin equivalent of, this is my name. Because each dolphin can recognize the presence of the others by a series of sounds called a signature whistle. Dolphins give themselves names. They establish an individual identity and express that symbolically through a particular type of sound. That's a remarkable insight to dolphins. They may not write poetry or build machines, but they seem to show the ability to use at least a rudimentary form of sound-based communication, and they use it very effectively to coordinate group activities. Chimpanzees and bonobos, they're higher apes. They're actually relatively related to us. There's some wonderful collection, one of the largest collections of bonobos in the U.S., by the way, is up at the Columbus Zoo. They're really fun to go watch. Not for that reason, but they're fun to watch. They're interesting animals. They actually, chimpanzees and bonobos, are tool users. They've been known to modify sticks and use them to fish for termites. They've been known to go around and find rocks of a particular size and hardness whose purpose it is to break apart sticks, rocks, or break open bones to be able to get at the marrow inside of them. So they use tools. They use other things to extend their physical abilities and give them capabilities that they would not have with simply fingers, arms, tongues, and so forth. We also see the development of something that goes beyond simply use of tools and use of language. We see the development of things that we begin to recognize as, and I'll put it in quotes, culture of behavior, meaning repeated patterns of behavior that are passed down from one generation to another. This is not just a one-time crazy dolphin acting in one particular way. We see repeated patterns in which juveniles of the species are instructed by the parents of that species in certain behaviors. And those behaviors are transmitted culturally, which means they are not transmitted through genetic means, like your skin color or the color or shape of your flipper is transmitted. So, for example, dolphins, we observe dolphin adults teaching juvenile dolphins how to use sponges to cap the ends of their noses to protect their snouts for certain types of operations where you might be going after something which would cause you to damage the fairly sensitive snout. Chimpanzees have been observed in the wild teaching their youngsters how to use stones to crack open nuts. And it's very clearly an actual level of instruction. Not in detail, maybe not with symbols, but showing by example. So it's not simply that you are a tool user or a communication user, but you passed those practices down through one's offspring, who then passed them down to their offspring. Intelligence opens up a second channel of heritability, what we call cultural heritability. And in human beings, we've seen that cultural heritability magnify our own history through what we call cultural evolution. When we developed language, especially when we developed writing and symbolic language, I can take my thoughts and transmit them all the way down through generations. I can see what people were thinking 2,000 years ago by reading, say, a Roman or a Greek poet. I can read a description of a scientific experiment that's 3,000 years old in a culture that I have only a vague connection with directly in terms of language or anything else, but because we can communicate those ideas down there, I can understand what they understood about, say, a particular mechanical design for lifting water 3,000 years ago. That's the power of language and cultural transmission, and we know that it's acted as a tremendous multiplier over and above evolutionary advantage. We go beyond the gifts of biology and begin to manipulate our environment and begin to form civilizations and cultures. That's one of the hallmarks of intelligence. A question, however, is how we measure this. And there's lots of ways to measure intelligence that have been suggested for human intelligence, the so-called intelligence quotient, or IQ. You can take or leave those as you wish. What we'd like to look at is some kind of biological measure that might be indicative of whether an animal other than human has a certain amount of intelligence, whether something correlates, some biological factor correlates with the appearance of these intelligent or intelligent-seeming behaviors. There's lots of these, but one of these that seems to be fairly useful to us here on Earth is something called the encephalization quotient. It appears to be a reasonable biological proxy for predicting whether a particular species has or may develop certain of these so-called intelligent traits. Now, EQ is pretty complex to define. It's basically the mass of the animal's brain divided by the average brain mass for the other species with the same body mass. So we take something that has the same basic body mass. Humans have an approximate body mass of about 100 kilos. Actually, it's a little under 100, a few tens of kilos. And we compare that to all the other animals that have roughly 100 kilo body mass, and we compare the ratio of their brain mass to the average brain mass for those creatures. And what we find is, if I take all the creatures with a body mass of about 100 kilos, find the average brain mass, and then say, is my brain mass bigger or smaller than that average? And you can do that as a function of different body mass. It's just a proxy for the animal size. It's interesting that if you draw this line here goes through the average body mass, the EQ of 1, for animals within a certain range of body mass. And so it goes up to some very big things, like whales, elephants, human beings, various primates here. You can see bigger than humans. Those are gorillas. Great gorillas are the most massive. Orangutans, the various great apes, and then down to some of the monkeys are down here at the very low masses, you know, vervet monkeys and small things. Birds run through a fairly large range of the red dots, and mammals of all kinds that are not primates are through here. So, of course, we get the whales and the elephants and the cats and dogs and things like that. And we can come up with the so-called encephalization quotient. Now, when plotted in this way, we notice, for example, that human beings are outliers from this general trend that the bigger your body is, the bigger your brain is. Well, duh, right? You got more body, you might need more brain to operate. The old myth about the fact that dinosaurs had gigantic bodies and brains the size of walnuts, not correct. But, you know, they fell on the encephalization quotient down here. People have tried to put them down here. It's hard to measure the mass of something you only have fossilized bones for, but people try it. So, for example, you'll notice that actual brain mass, there are a number of creatures which have much more massive brains than humans. Elephants, for example. Certain species of whales have huge brains, but they have small encephalization quotients compared to averages down inside of them. So it isn't just the size of your brain, it's the size of your brain relative to your body. So let's look at some of these numbers. How does Earth life measure up in this case? Now, there's lots of numbers, but I'll give you the ones we care about. Human beings have an encephalization quotient of 7. That means our brains are 7 times more massive than the brains of other creatures of our total body mass. So I take all primates, mammals of, you know, weighing with masses between, say, 50 and 150 kilos, and I add up the average brain mass of all those different mammals and primates. Our brain is 7 times more massive than the average brain within that body mass group. That's a huge difference. Dolphins are 4.5 times, have brains which are 4.5 times more massive for animals of their size. In fact, dolphins start to overlap a little bit with humans. Some dolphins are down around a couple hundred kilos. Chimpanzees, which are smaller than humans, have an encephalization quotient of 2.5. And our favorite companion animals, the cats and dogs, have an encephalization quotient of 1. Your cat or your dog is average. Oh, my cats are kind of stupid, but, you know, they kind of work that way. I think, you know, are they? I don't know. Maybe they're not so stupid. They do seem to wake me up and know when to be fed, and I seem to have managed to control us well enough that we keep them fed, so maybe not. But anyway, back to the more serious stuff. The encephalization quotient appears to correlate with complex behaviors. We only have a small number of examples here on the planet, because only a very small number of species have really big encephalization quotients. Among them, humans, chimpanzees, bonobos, and dolphin species. But we recognize among those groups what makes them stand out is they display the kinds of complex behaviors we consider as clever or perhaps intelligent. They show sometimes use of tools. They show vocalizations that show the rudiments of language and communications. They show other behaviors which are more complex than simply eating, surviving, and reproducing. Now, is encephalization quotient just simply a numerical game? Possibly, and some people have some problems with it. But there is some interesting studies that have shown that encephalization quotient can be seen to increase over a number of generations. Now, again, it's challenging to do this for dead species, but if you go back a few tens of millions of years, we do find fossil dolphins and fossil whales. And you can estimate the encephalization quotients for those animals through the various times. So we have here ancient dolphins and whales are the squares, the diamonds are the toothed whales, and the green squares are what we'd recognize as more modern dolphins. There were distant ancestors, there's a nice deposit of those about 15 million years ago, and these are the modern variants. And what you see in this plot is a general trend of an increase from earlier species to later species. As the species have evolved, the successful ones have apparently seen an increase in the encephalization coefficient. So what does this mean? Well, one part of this is a suggestion that the encephalization quotient is in some sense a partially heritable trait. If your parents had a large encephalization quotient, your offspring, should have a similar encephalization quotient as well. That shouldn't be too surprising. There's not a lot of variation in encephalization quotient within a given species. Furthermore, one can make an argument that possessing intelligence, complex behaviors that we equate with intelligence on the Earth, do appear to be correlated with an encephalization quotient. Bigger-brained creatures, relative to their peers in body mass, chimpanzees, dolmens, and humans, do appear to show this behavior with intelligent behavior. So we often can make this leap that there is a correlation, that more clever behavior seems to correlate with a higher encephalization quotient. One can then tie these two together, and again, the links get a little shaky here, but we'll say it anyway. We can make the argument that from an evolutionary point of view, intelligence provides a certain amount of survival capability. If your ability to organize into groups so that individuals become, as a group, become more than just the sum of those individuals, if intelligence allows you to do that because you can use communication to socially tie you together, if you begin to develop tools which allows you to be stronger, quicker, bigger and badder than other creatures that have your same body mass, that can give you an evolutionary advantage. You are more likely to survive and pass those traits and those cultural behaviors onto your offspring and they to theirs, thereby giving you an evolutionary advantage over creatures that do not have that capability, right? If primal human beings did not have a high encephalization quotient, were not tool-using or very crudely tool-using, they basically are way down on the food chain, right? They're going to be cheetah food or lion food because they can't fight back with soft, you know, fingernails and soft skin against claws and teeth like this. But when they learn to use sticks or rocks or begin to get tools which magnify human muscle power to where now you can actually successfully fight off a predator, then your inborn biological limitations are no longer a factor in your survivability in a complex biosphere, in a complex environment. And you become now magnified beyond what your biological gifts are. So intelligence gives you an advantage in surviving. If you survive, you have offspring, and your offspring learn from you those techniques to survive. That's what this is all about. But beware. That's a very nice little just-so story, but it's still a just-so story because while intelligence may grant an evolutionary advantage, do not mistake evolutionary advantage for guarantee of evolutionary success. Remember, the biggest, baddest, most well-adapted creature that ever walked on the face of this planet was Tyrannosaurus Rex. Where's T-Rex now? It's bones in museums because an asteroid whacked the Earth at just the wrong time 65 million years ago, and those species could no longer survive. Whatever intelligence, and there's a good chance T-Rex may have in fact been developing intelligence, or for those of you fans of the Jurassic Park movies, Velociraptor. It's not crazy that these creatures may have developed forms of intelligence. Many of them had high encephalization quotients. But that didn't help them when the asteroid whacked the Chicxulub Basin 65 million years ago because it changed the rules of the environment. It made survival now a lot more difficult, and they simply couldn't hack it, and they vanished. Doesn't matter how smart you are, you get whacked on the head with an asteroid, you could be in trouble. So beware. Advantage does not mean a guarantee. Right? There's no guarantees in life at all. Simple play. So what can we learn about intelligence? We define intelligence in the way we have. What was one of the things we can learn now looking back over the history of life on our planet? One of the most stark lessons that comes out right away is that intelligence at the level of a human being's or a dolphin or even a chimpanzee and bonobo, tool using rudimentary language or even advanced intelligence like we like to believe we possess, took a really, really long time to emerge. This is the picture we've seen all through this class of all of the Earth's history laid out from the point of formation through the Hadean, Archean, Protozoic periods. Life was pretty well single-celled through most of this 4.5 billion years. Only in the last 600 million years or so did complex multicellular animal and plant life emerge. It didn't get out onto the land until 400 million years ago. Mammals and dinosaurs, our ancestors, the mammals, didn't emerge until a little over 220 million years ago. The dinosaurs pretty much ruled until 65 million years ago when T-Rex and his buddies went the way of the dinosaur in the asteroid impact that formed the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary. And then mammals had about 65 million years to claw their way upwards, but the first recognizable human beings, Homo sapiens, intelligent hominids, wise hominids to be more precise in the Latin, first appear 100,000 years ago. So we're a late arrival, we being intelligence, or dolphins with large encephalization quotients emerged during the last few million years. Probably the early primates, the proto-humans, the things that were pre-Homo sapiens, that are our distant ancestors, common ancestors of the great apes that are now our sort of very distant relatives, probably had fairly high encephalization quotients and began the process of emerged as intelligence, but they're only a few million years. So the way I like to think about it is, if all of the history of the Earth from formation to the present day could be compressed into 1 year, what we recognize as higher human intelligence, symbolic thinking, language, tools, abstract behavior, the ability to create art simply perhaps for the sake of art and complex symbols, occurred during the last fraction of a second of that year. So human intelligence, the higher intelligence that we recognize in terms of the history of the Earth, is very, very rare. It took a long time, more than 4 billion years, to emerge on this planet. That's going to be an important input into understanding what we're going to be looking for if we're going to want to find not just life, but intelligent life. Intelligent life, if the Earth is any lesson, is exceedingly rare. Now, what has intelligence done for us? Okay, we can go back to about between 2.5 million years up to about 7-10,000 BC with stone tools. Once we go in through the emergence of late stone tools, the development of the ability to use various kinds of metallurgy, the ability to get better and more advanced tools, advanced forms of language, advanced forms of cultural organization, the emergence of cities, the emergence of language, written language, we see a tremendous growth in the human species. We have become, from a purely biological point of view, phenomenally successful. There was one little blast dip down here around the time of the Black Death. And then what happened around in here? The Renaissance, the development of science, the development of mathematics, the development of the ability not simply to manipulate things through human power, but the ability to actually tap other sources of energy, wood, then water, then coal, then oil, then the atom. There's been a tremendous burst in the growth of the human population. If you want to gauge success of any living thing by how many they are, how successful they are at the most basic of things, eat, survive, reproduce, and make copies of yourself, human beings have been spectacularly successful. And this time scale of a few thousand years is way, way, way too fast for biological evolution. The difference between us in terms of our biological makeup, in terms of our genetic makeup, and the difference between those people who left the cave paintings inside those French caves 30,000 years ago is virtually zero. We haven't actually evolved biologically since that time. In fact, one can argue from various evidences that we haven't shown any signs of genetic variation of this point that calls speciation for more than 100,000 years. And yet in the last few years, things have evolved dramatically in terms of our numbers. How? Through cultural evolution, through technology, through the use of language, the use of tools. Our tools have gotten vastly more sophisticated and put tremendous energies at our disposal. Score one for the human intelligence. It's a huge, when you get past certain threshold of technology and ability, it's an enormous multiplier over and above biological processes. This is why intelligence, when it emerges, seems to emerge extremely fast once you cross some threshold of tool use, of language use, of organization that goes along with that. Provided, of course, something doesn't happen. Now, there's a flip side to the use of tools. Let's say I want to develop tools to the point that now we have long-range radio communication, that we actually produce radio signals that extend out 100 light years away from the Earth. We've built spacecraft, robotic spacecraft, that are moving sufficiently fast now that within a few decades they have actually left the bounds of our solar system or are on their way into interstellar space. We have the ability to manipulate not just simply simple matter at the level of making things out of sticks and stones. We can make things out of single atoms. This carries a flip side with it. It means for each of those advances, we get into more and more energetic sources of energy, more and more powerful sources of energy. And with them comes a tremendous amount of danger. And that danger is we've now begun to tap into sources of energy which are far, far bigger than we are. I'm not saying this sort of like, oh, we're doomed, but saying, look, this is one of the prices that high intelligence has paid. It's allowed us to tap into the energy of the atom, to understand the structure of matter at the smallest scales. But by doing so, we now have the technical capability to destroy our own species. So while it's given us tremendous advantages in survival, it's also put in our hands instrumentalities that, if we are not careful with, could actually end that run. Doesn't matter how intelligent we are, if our finger's on the wrong button, we're in trouble. So maybe score minus one for here. The reason I bring this up is to make the point that this may also turn into a limiting factor in intelligence elsewhere. That when intelligence grows to the point that it can make its presence known to the rest of the universe, also means that it has developed instrumentalities which include the ability to destroy itself. It's a sobering thought, an uncomfortable thought, but that comes hand in hand with it. If you're going to travel to the stars, the kind of energies you need are the energies that can also destroy a world. So what do we mean by intelligent species that develops advanced technology? What's the advantage of that? It can make itself known to intelligent species elsewhere. We've never really fully communicated with another species on our own planet. We know the dolphins talk to each other at some level. They communicate through sound systems that seem to carry information, unique information. They're speaking, they're using a form of language that we sort of recognize, although we don't see symbols in there yet, per se. Chimpanzees can recognize, too. We can train chimps to use certain rudimentary forms of language, but we don't know if we're actually communicating or is it just simply advanced training. Those experiments with chimps, for example, using certain types of symbol keyboards and communicating with their handlers, there are those who would argue they're just simply well-trained and you develop a form of communication, but it may just be advanced training. Those are controversial ideas. But let's really push it up to saying we encounter someone whose intelligence, skills, and available technical instrumentalities are the same as our own. We want to call that advanced technology. Not merely sticks and stones, but the ability to send radio signals, which means the ability to manipulate and create electromagnetic radiation. That's what it really means. We can manipulate matter at the atomic level. That's what we're doing. And to build and send out, and have the will to do so, spacecraft capable of traveling interstellar distances, however slowly. So we can build systems that can send very powerful beamed directed radio sources anywhere we want to in the sky. And we have built spacecraft that are capable of leaving the gravity of our own solar system and heading out into interstellar space. They do it kind of slowly, but they're doing it. By this criterion, human technology only qualifies as advanced only very recently. We've only had this capability in the last century. It's interesting that during that same century is the time in which we've harnessed the power of the atom, the power of electromagnetic radiation, and the power of electrons. What am I using with computers, cell phones, everything else, are devices using silicon crystals to manipulate electrons. That's one of the primary pieces of our technology today, is becoming the transmission of information through the manipulation of electrons. That's a long, long ways from sticks and stones. Now, here's a question. Does high intelligence inevitably lead to advanced technology? Could you have extremely high levels of intelligence, extremely high levels of self-awareness, extremely high levels of symbolic, abstract reasoning, language, but not have an advanced technology? Well, we think one of the things that actually allows us to have developing a technology is having appendages that can actually manipulate objects and make tools that are useful. These are things we may need as prerequisites for having technology. Okay, some of this is embedded in our language. To manipulate means to work with the hands, so I'm kind of forced by our language to use words about, you know, putting my will on other things. We speak of as being manipulative, the Latin mani, meaning hand, right? We think of our interaction with things as we reach out and we grab them. Well, we can do that because we have fingers and we have opposable thumbs. If you don't have opposable thumbs, that might limit the kind of tools you can use. Think about what life without your thumbs would be like. How you would manipulate things if you possessed no thumbs, if you only had four straight fingers. What if you have flippers and no hands? How do you manipulate things? You don't have a mani to pullulate with. Right? So dolphins could be extremely intelligent. They could be, in fact, the most profound poets and philosophers on our planets, but they can't make a lever and they can't throw a rock. Does that make them less intelligent? Or does it mean that they're highly intelligent, but they will never develop an advanced technology because they have no way to manipulate their environment beyond bumping their nose into things? So maybe having appendages is important. Maybe if we actually do someday walk up and meet an extraterrestrial, maybe we really will shake hands with them because they had hands to develop technology or something like that. Now, the other question, of course, is we talk about advanced civilization in terms of radio signals that are going out into space. We talk about tools. We talk about the manipulation of energy. There are other forms of intelligence that may not make themselves known. Maybe our definition of intelligence and for intelligence life elsewhere is a little bit narrow. Maybe forms of intelligence and forms of culture can arise that don't make themselves known, that don't use electromagnetic radiation to broadcast Jersey Shore to the stars. So I'll just leave you with this thought that a world of Zen monks would not broadcast to the stars reality TV. There are other forms of intelligence that might not make their presence known. Any questions? Okay. I will see you all tomorrow, and we'll start the search for the intelligence signals.